Greetings and glutinous lipidations, my nasophoretically cretaceous listeners, and welcome to the September 2015 Science News Update. I'm your host for this polyamorous, sublocutionary science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Welcome back to school, kiddies. I'm sure that a lot of parents are letting out sighs of relief. I sure as heck know I am. Let's just get to it.
We don't need no stinking preliminaries.
You know how I love me some world records? Well, here's the latest. What's the biggest known structure in the universe? Astronomers used to think it was a filament of galaxies known as the Sloan Great Wall, about 1.4 billion years across. But recent research suggests a different structure that's even bigger, and its size has astronomers scratching their head. The Hercules Corona Borealis Great Wall is about 4 billion light years across, and it is now the biggest thing yet discovered. It's so big that some astronomers do not even believe it can exist. An international team of astronomers has found what appears to be the largest feature in the observable universe, a ring of 9 gamma-ray bursts, galaxies, which are 5 billion light-years across. The scientists, led by Professor Lajos Balogh of Konkoly Observatory in Budapest, reported on their find in August. Gamma-ray bursts are the most luminous events in the universe, releasing as much energy in a few seconds as the sun does over 10 billion years. They are thought to be the result of massive stars collapsing into black holes. Their huge luminosity helps astronomers to map out the location of distant galaxies. The bursts that make up the newly discovered ring were observed using a variety of space and ground-based observatories. They appear to be very similar distances from us, about 7 billion light-years away, in a circle about 36 degrees across the sky, or more than 70 times the diameter of the full moon. Professor Balogh says that, quote, "This implies that the ring is more than 4 to 5 billion light-years across, and there is only a 1 in 20,000 chance that the bursts are in this distribution by chance," unquote. Most current astronomical models suggest that the structure of the cosmos is kind of uniform on the largest scales. The cosmological principle is backed up by observations of the early universe and its microwave background radiation. Other results, more recent, suggest that this new discovery challenged that principle, which sets a theoretical limit of about 1.2 billion light-years for the largest structures. The newly discovered ring is almost 5 times that big. Balogh says, quote, "If the ring represents a real spatial structure, then it has to be seen nearly face-on because of the small variations of the gamma-ray burst distances around the object's center. The ring, though, instead could be a projection of a sphere, where the gamma-ray bursts all occurred within a 250 million-year period, a short timescale compared with the age of the universe," unquote. Balogh comments, quote, "If we are right, the structure contradicts the current models of the universe. It was a huge surprise to find something this big, and we still don't quite understand how it could come to exist at all," unquote. As I said, there is some controversy here. I have a quote from one dissenting astronomer who asked to remain anonymous. The astronomer was quite unimpressed with Balogh, to say the least. Here's what he said. Quote, "Big friggin' deal. So he detected 9 gamma ray bursts, and if you use a marker to connect dots, they form a circle. I can see more than 9 gamma ray bursts in my instruments, and they don't form a circle. However, being fair, if we accept for the moment Balogh's idea, how can you tell it's a structure? In a real structure, the points are related in one way or another. Here, considering the distances between them, it becomes absurd. To me, it's all just a coincidence. Idiot." Unquote. Whoa, dude. I like when scientists stop being polite and get real. Sorry. Next story. Here's a little something, just to annoy some of you. I rarely mention transgenic plants because the last time I did, several years ago, I talked about this in some detail on the show here, and several listeners freaked out on me and sent me hate mail. However, this story is just too good to ignore. All too often, those who are most vehement about GMO crops bolster their beliefs by insisting that transgenic plants are simply unnatural. Nature would not produce such abominations, so why should we put up with it in our grocery stores? In the August issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy, Dr. Tina Kint of Ghent University and her colleagues reported that even wild sweet potatoes are not quite as natural as the environmentalists would make us think. Kint discovered that the sweet potato plant naturally contains genes from Agrobacterium tDNA. That is the genetic vector which is commonly used to genetically engineer plants nowadays in most laboratories. And they found that this makes the sweet potato a naturally genetically modified plant. The discovery suggests that an early ancestor of the sweet potato came into contact with Agrobacterium, upon which something called horizontal gene transfer occurred. Horizontal gene transfer, in one definition, is the transfer of genes between species in this case. The genes have been conserved in the plant genome until this time. The finding adds to the controversial topic of the regulation of genetically modified organisms, especially because consumable plants that have been genetically engineered in the lab using Agrobacterium are currently subjected to heavy regulation. Perhaps the most surprising thing is the finding that a gene was disrupted by one of the tDNA insertions. And that phenomenon is deemed unacceptable when making a GMO crop. Kint's study could challenge current views on the biosafety and regulation of GM crops. Hey, look, I said this years ago, and I will repeat it. Humans and nature have been naturally modifying plants for years. The only difference now is that the genetic tools allow us to do it much faster than we would have done it 5,000 years ago. And in this case that we're talking about, it wasn't even humans that did it. It was a natural phenomenon. We see this over and over again, even in my own work. For example, I have an ongoing project at the moment which suggests that a whole family of genes found in modern plants originated in a horizontal transfer of genetic material from soil bacteria to the earliest of plant progenitors. It happens. Okay. Next story, prions. Frankly, I don't remember whether I've spoken to you about prions or not, but let me do that before I tell you the story. It'll help the story make a little more sense, I think. Prions are not bacteria. They're not alive. They're not even as complex as viruses, which are also not alive. They are something completely different. They are infective proteins that turn good versions of a protein into copies of themselves, bad proteins. They don't have DNA. They don't have RNA. You could think of them sort of like zombie proteins. Once they get a hold of another protein, they turn them into another infective, pathogenic, zombie version of themselves. Usually these proteins are neural in function. They're found in the brain and the spinal cord. There is a disease which resembles Parkinson's called multiple system atrophy. It's a neurodegenerative disorder. It was first discovered in 1960, and new research suggests that multiple system atrophy is caused by a unique prion. This is the first new prion to be associated with a human disease in 50 years. Fittingly, the new discovery is the work of a research team that includes Dr. Stanley Prusner, the Nobel Prize winner who first identified prions back in 1982. That's what the Nobel Prize was for. Prions have been implicated in several related neural diseases, including scrapies in sheep, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which most people know as bad cow disease, in cattle, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is a prion disease in humans. Dr. Kurt Giles of the University of California, San Francisco, is the senior author of the new research paper, which is entitled Evidence for Alpha-Synuclein prions, causing multiple system atrophy in humans with Parkinsonism. Now, the paper appeared August 31st in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The researchers examined 14 human brain homogenates for transmission of the prion to mice already expressing one copy of the alpha-synuclein gene. The alpha-synuclein is the prion protein. They found the mice that ended up with two copies of the prion protein developed neurological dysfunction. The team found that the brains of infected mice contained abnormally high levels of insoluble human alpha-synuclein, and that infected mouse brain tissue could itself spread the disease to other mice. Giles says, "Our findings argue that multiple system atrophy is caused by a unique strain of alpha-synuclein prion, which is different from other prions, causing spontaneous neurodegeneration in homozygous mice." Unquote. Discovery that alpha-synuclein prions can transmit multiple system atrophy raises a public health concern, mainly about treatments and research that involve contact with brain tissue for neurodegenerative patients. This is because standard disinfection techniques that kill microbes do not eliminate prions that cause Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Whether the same challenges hold for alpha-synuclein prions in multiple system atrophy remain to be seen. The authors warn that clinicians and researchers should adopt much more stringent safety protocols when dealing with tissue from patients with multiple system atrophy and other neurodegenerative diseases, many of which they believe may be caused by prions. Giles finishes with this warning, quote, "You can't kill a protein. It can stick tightly to stainless steel, even when the surgical instrument is cleaned. We're advocating a precautionary approach. People are living longer and likely getting more brain surgeries. Infection with prion-contaminated neural tissue could mean a real worry for infection if we are not careful." Unquote. This does seem like nasty stuff, doesn't it? The next story also comes from the Proceedings of the National Academy from last month. Copying and making DNA in a cell is not a perfect process. And that process of replication occasionally results in a mismatched base pair on the newly constructed strand of DNA, the daughter strand. The cell's repair machinery is able to usually identify this quickly and fix that type of error. But how do you do that repair if you have to identify the new strand? Until recently, it hasn't been entirely clear how the new strand has been identified as opposed to the old strand. Until recently, the consensus was that the repair proteins slid up and down the strands of DNA to find a protein that marked the new strand. Now researchers have tracked the repair proteins with fluorescent tags to show that rather than sliding, the proteins stay put and assemble themselves into a filament to reach out and probe the marker. During DNA replication, one in a million base pairs is inserted incorrectly. For example, if A was matched with a G instead of a C. As replication continues, specialized repair proteins follow closely behind to inspect the work and ensure that it's all been done right. When mismatches occur, a protein called MUT-S finds the error, and another protein called MUT-L snips it out. And then other proteins can complete the repair and replace the base. Dr. Keith Winiger of North Carolina State University has now discovered a protein called PCNA that is loaded onto protein in a certain orientation. By observing the PCNA's orientation, the MUT-S and the MUT-L proteins can figure out which strand is the one that was just newly made. Winiger says PCNA can be up to 1,000 base pairs away from where the repair happens, so there's somehow communication across that distance. Unquote. In the absence of MUT-L, MUT-S has been observed to slide along the DNA after identifying mismatches, suggesting that it may slide toward PCNA to probe its orientation and then slide back to perform the repair. To see if they could catch MUT-S in the act of sliding back and forth, Winiger's team used single-molecule imaging with fluorescently tagged Mutt S and Mutt L to observe this. The team found that Mutt S actually stays put and instead recruits more Mutt L to its location. Moniker says, quote, "This observation supports a model in which Mutt L binds to Mutt S and assembles into a filament-like structure that spans the gap between the mismatch and PCNA to decide which side to repair," unquote. Because MUT-S interactions with DNA mismatches actually lead to repair events only about 20% of the time, the protein's function has been difficult to actually characterize or figure out before now. The last story of the night is about our ancestors. Dr. Lee Berger of the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa, and his colleagues have reported this month on some new ancestors of ours that they have just found. Whether it's ever occurred to you or not, humans are the only species of our kind on Earth left anymore. Dogs and cats have relatives in their genuses. Beetles do. Monkeys do. Just about everything on Earth does, but we do not. Homo sapiens are now the only living species in our genus. But as recently as 100,000 years ago, there were several other species that belonged to the genus Homo. Together with modern humans, these extinct human species, our immediate ancestors and their close relatives, are collectively referred to as hominins. Now Berger and his colleagues report the recent discovery of an extinct species from the genus Homo that has been unearthed from deep underground in what has been named the Dinaledi Chamber in the Rising Star Cave System in South Africa. The species was named Homo naledi. Naledi means star in the Sotho language of South Africa. The unearthed fossils were from at least 15 individuals and include multiple examples of most of the bones in the skeleton. Based on this wide range of specimens from a single site, Berger describes the Homo naledi as being similar in size and weight to a small modern human, with human-like hands and feet. Further, while the skull had several unique features, it had a small brain case that was most similar in size to other early human species that lived between 4 and 2 million years ago. Homo naledi's ribcage, shoulders, and pelvis also more closely resembled those of earlier hominin species than those of modern humans. The Naledi fossils are the largest collection of a single species of hominin that has been discovered in Africa so far. However, since the age of the fossils remains unclear, one of the next challenges will be to date the remains to provide more information about the early evolution of humans and their close relatives. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Keep away from other people's prion-ridden brains. Keep looking for other members of the human genus. They're out there. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.